Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. The Kevin O'Leary-backed Utah data center project seeks a new water right. Not all Box Elder County ranchers agree with Utah House Speaker on data center project plans. And Utah's top lawmaker has received huge sums from companies and lobbyists with MIDA projects. Joining me today are Salt Lake Tribune water and land use reporter Leah Larson. Leah, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. We have with us as well reporter Tony Semerad. Tony, thank you.
Hi there.
Hi. Later in the program, we'll hear from State Watch reporter Emily Anderson Stern. Leah Larson, let's start with you. Let's start with the new water right. I guess maybe in contrast, tell us about the former water right that was applied for, protested against, and then withdrawn.
Yeah, that one was interesting. So that was for 1,900 acres of water, which is about enough water to meet the basic needs of 4,000 Utah households, which sounds like a lot, but for a data center isn't a ton. And we have heard from some of these data center developers that they're going to seek up to 13,000 acre feet in water rights. So this 1,900 was a small chunk of that. But man, did it receive a lot of protests. I think soon after it became public, it started racking up something like hundreds of them. So I thought, like, well, I'll make a spreadsheet, figure out who's filing these protests, where they're from, because you have to put your address on them. And what are the general concerns? But it quickly ballooned to thousands and thousands. I think it's at close to 4,000 at this point. So I did not complete my spreadsheet, but a lot of the sentiments seem to be the same, that, you know, concerns over water, the Great Salt Lake, that this is just not the place to build a thing like this. But that water right, it was filed by a ranch owner called Bar H Ranch. They rescinded the application from the state engineer, but they did indicate they're going to refile, that they plan to move forward. And now we have a new one, like you mentioned, which we can talk about a little more if you'd like.
Yeah, tell me about that one. It's much smaller.
Much smaller. And I think it just kind of goes to show that there's a hodgepodge of land ownership out here, which will also mean that, you know, like these data center developers are going to have to buy up a ton of water rights and patch them together. But so this one is owned by an entity called Murray Hollow LC. The owner lives in the Salt Lake area. Much smaller, 11 acre feet. So that's about enough water to meet the household needs, like 20 households in Utah. So much smaller, not even a drip in the amount of water this data center is going to need, but I think it's all going to accumulate over time. And this one, like the last one, has already racked up hundreds of protests. I just checked this morning, and I think it's getting close to 400. So, I think that, I've never seen anything like this amount of protests filed for a water right before, and I've been covering water for pretty much all of my career, and I've talked to other community organizers and things, and they've said the same thing. And I think it just goes to show that the public is sort of eager for an outlet to express their concerns and get them noted and read and heard by somebody, because I feel like maybe the sentiment is this thing is kind of getting rammed through without a lot of questions being answered.
How much water is the data center going to need? It's my impression they're going to have to file for a bunch of water rights, won't they?
Yeah, sure seems that way. I mean, data centers do use water, even the ones that are quote unquote more sustainable, I guess. What they have said publicly, like I said, is they'll seek a total of 13,000 acre feet. They've said they won't use it all, but that just kind of raises the question then, you know, then why are you going after that much water if you don't plan to use it all? And I think like a lot of what we've heard is like, don't worry, everybody, it's going to be a quote unquote closed loop system to cool the data center. It's not going to use that much water. Well, closed loop systems, that's just a vague term. That's not a specific technology. There are closed loop systems that still use a lot of water, just depending on the technology they're using. And, you know, like these things have to get charged every so often and flushed and recharged. But what you don't really hear a lot of talk about is the associated natural gas plant that's going to power this data center. Like, we don't know, are they going to use generators? Or are they going to use traditional steam turbines? Because whatever they're planning to do with the natural gas plant could also be a big consumer of water. So there's just a lot of things we don't know about this thing yet.
By the way, Governor Cox, in a recent statement, said it's his understanding or the fact that organizers should not use only natural gas.
Yeah, Yes, and I think this is creating some more consternation with the public in that we're getting sort of contradictory messaging from state officials, depending in the developers, depending on who you're talking to. So the Military Installation Development Authority, which was kind of the first Utah entity, government entity to sign off on this thing that made it land on everybody else's radar. So they've been sort of out there cheerleading this data center project, and what they have said to the Box Elder County Commission and others is that this data center will be powered 100% by natural gas. The whole reason they selected this site in Hansel Valley was because this Ruby pipeline runs through it from Wyoming to California, Nevada, carrying natural gas, and that's the whole reason that they want to build here. And then again, it's going to be 100% natural gas powered, is what we've heard from one state entity. And then we have Governor Cox, after some of the backlash and the blowback, he posted a series of posts on X where he said it won't be all natural gas. He's talking to the developer about using renewables. And then just this week, he kind of said that again, that it will not be 100% natural gas, that it will have some component of either a nuclear or renewables or something that's less emissive, less prone to generate pollution. So we'll see. I mean, I think that's kind of the issue with this, right? It's so conceptual at this point. There's so many unanswered questions.
By the way, back to the water rights. There's a new bill, right? New policy under House Bill 60, you note.
Oh yeah. Just went into effect this month. Yeah, what timing? Yeah, so that bill kind of reins in the state engineer. So the state engineer, she helms the Utah Division of Water Rights. She signs off on new water rights. She signs off on applications to change water rights to different uses, like from agricultural to industrial. So she has to sign off on all of that. And yes, lawmakers this year, I got the impression it was kind of at her request. They reined in her ability to consider issues beyond like water availability and impacts to surrounding water users. So if there's something that another division or agency is supposed to consider, like air quality, like impacts to wildlife, impacts to recreation, she doesn't factor that into her decision. She's only going to consider those narrow things, like is there enough water available? Will it impact other water users in the area? So that was one of the most controversial bills to come out of this last legislative session. People were really worried that that would mean that like environmental watchdog groups, for example, have no ability to actually protest or sue the state over decisions made by the state engineer. And you know, I've heard some people speculate that maybe that's why Bar H rescinded that application a few weeks ago and plan to refile, because if they refile, now this new legislation has become law. It went into effect at the start of the month. So maybe, I don't know, the timing is interesting.
She also says that she will not base her decision on the quantity of protests.
No, and you know she shouldn't. You know she should be, you know, equal and impartial to all this and just do her job. So you get it. But you know, even if she's not considering it, I'm sure that it's gotten a lot of people's attention at the state that this, you know, deluge of protests being filed against this thing, I'm sure has got some people's attention.
Let's move to another story. Utahns will have more chances to weigh in on Kevin O'Leary's data center project. You're quoting this story, the Utah Department of Environmental Quality's head, who said, "Hey, we'll have to weigh in on this."
Yeah. I mean, I was kind of thinking about this, like just seeing this deluge of water rights protests pour in over this thing. People are obviously have a lot of anxieties about it, right? And I think they do feel like their voice isn't being heard. For example, that very contentious Box Elder County Commission meeting, where they wouldn't take verbal public comments, I think really annoyed a lot of people and frustrated a lot of people. Like they want to share their concerns. So we were thinking like, well, what other outlets are there available to the public moving forward? And there are several. So this data center and its natural gas plant, it's going to create emissions, right? So they're going to have to get air quality permits. So the public will be able to weigh in on that process. There's like a 30-day public comment period that the state will advertise. They'll probably have a public hearing if they get enough interest. And I can't imagine this won't get enough interest. But so the public can weigh in on that. They can kind of scrutinize whether this data center is actually implementing the best air control technology, then we'll have a better idea of like what they actually plan to build out there, because they're going to have to explain it a lot better. It can't be like these vague pie in the sky things. And the same thing with water quality. There's going to be another process, because we've heard the developers say that they intend to treat water at the site and return it to the environment and help refill the Great Salt Lake, which is, again, we don't know if that's true, if that's for sure. But if they are planning to discharge water into the environment, they're going to have to make sure that water is clean and not going to impact the ecology, that the water is not going to be too hot. So, water quality permitting, we'll review all that. The public will get a chance to look at those draft permits and make sure that they feel good about them. So they have a chance to comment on all that. And then there's also going to be stormwater monitoring as the site is constructed. And we all expect this will take a decade or more to fully build out. So there's going to be ongoing permitting for stormwater pollution. Just based on the sheer size of this thing and its location, they're probably going to have to like build some kind of drinking water treatment plant for workers and visitors. So there will be a permitting process for that. So this isn't by no means over, and the public, as the public's ability to weigh in is not over. So.
One of the concerns I was interested to see, Wasatch Front just barely made it off the EPA's dirty air list. But if you get a bunch of, I guess, pollution coming in from Hansel Valley, that could affect that.
I mean, that's a great point. I'm glad you brought that up. We have such a unique geology in this state, don't we? So we're, our urban core, 75% of our state's entire population is pinched between like the Great Salt Lake and Utah Lake in the mountains, right? And then so like this bowl topography creates our inversion conditions, right? Because it makes this like essentially a pot, and then the weather sets in and puts a lid over the pot. So even though Hansel Valley and this data center seem really remote, like far away, it takes a long time to drive there and get there from Salt Lake City, for example, it's really not, because all this these emissions, this pollution could just kind of drift over the lake and over into our major population center, where, as you said, we just got off the EPA's dirty air list for our wintertime inversion pollution. We're still under the microscope for our ozone pollution. That remains an issue. So there is a lot of concern that all these gains that we've made are now just going to be set back, not just by this data center, but there are data centers all over the Wasatch Front that are looking at building natural gas plants. And, like natural gas, despite its name, it's a lot cleaner than burning coal, don't get me wrong, but natural gas is still a pretty potent greenhouse gas, and burning it releases carbon. It can release the precursors that form inversion pollution and ozone pollution. So it definitely has a lot of environmental watchdogs worried. And I think a lot of people in the state too are kind of biting their fingernails about this. Like, how are we going to accommodate these kinds of things?
Let's move to another story. We fit this one in. Very important. I'll just read the first line of your story. Following Utah's winter of NOPAC, Governor Spencer Cox has declared a state of emergency over drought conditions. You have some pretty stark statistics here. Maybe give those to us. This year's snowpack versus last year's, and then the big one of 23.
Oh yeah, and I have to say, NOPAC, that is not my term. I think I first heard it from Joel Ferry, the commissioner of our Department of Natural Resources, but it is very creative and an apt descriptor. So let's rattle off some stats. So on April 1st, when our snowpack is supposed to peak every year, we had an average statewide of 2.7 inches of snow water equivalent, which is the amount of water that's contained within that snowpack up in the mountains. When it melts, how much water will it release? So there was 2.7 inches of snow water equivalent this year. Usually it should be around 14 inches at the start of April. So bad, very, very bad. And then like in 2023, if you remember our record-breaking snowpack that was just insane, that had 28 inches of snow water equivalent on April 1st. So again, this year we were at 2.7, so very, very bad. It has people very stressed out, especially our water managers.
So this state of emergency, what does that mean? Are there going to be mandatory conservation efforts?
Yeah, so I guess the reason they're so stressed out about the snowpack is, in case your listeners don't know, 95% of our water in Utah is dependent on snowpack and reservoirs, and those reservoirs refilling, or the snowpack recharging aquifers. So Sounds like the governor is going to kind of leave it up to individual water districts, which sort of makes sense because, you have Central Utah Water Conservancy District. They have these huge reservoirs like Strawberry Reservoir and Jordanelle that can accommodate, I think, up to 7 years worth of storage. So we could go through 7 years like this with no runoff, essentially, no water replenishing our reservoirs, and they would still be fine in that part of the state. But up where I am at Weber Basin, they only have 2 years worth of reservoir storage, so they're very stressed out. So the governor's kind of leaving it up to the water districts to figure out what kind of restrictions to put in place and how to enforce them. But he did caution that enforcement will be happening. So don't be watering willy-nilly. We all have our part to play.
There's a stat, here it is, around 65% of residential water in the state is used outdoors, which is, I think a lot of us would think that's too much.
Yeah, I think a lot of water managers would agree with that. And I think it probably makes sense to Utahns. Like your water bill definitely goes up in the summer when you've, at least mine does. I don't have secondary water, so mine definitely goes up in the summer when you have to start irrigating your garden. And the other thing I think that's interesting about that too to keep in mind is that the water that we use outdoors, a lot of it just evaporates away and leaves the system, whereas the water we use indoors is treated. And it, up here in the northern part of the state where we are, it ends up in the Great Salt Lake. Some of the only water actually guaranteed to finally make it to the Great Salt Lake. And then, of course, down south, it will end up in the Colorado River system or maybe get recycled. So that's water we can recapture to some extent, whereas the water we use outdoors just kind of turns into grass that gets mowed down and some of it just evaporates away into the environment. So, yes, the water managers really, really are encouraging people to rethink their landscaping. Like now is the time to take advantage of some of those incentives that water districts offer and rip out some of your turf grass that maybe is water intensive or replace it with less intensive grass or water intensive grass, water wise landscaping. We had a story also this week, a water wise landscape doesn't just have to be gravel and mulch. It can be very beautiful. You can have some drought tolerant plantings and things. And they've done a lot of interesting experiments and studies on grasses that are more suitable to our climate. So those are worth looking at as well.
Yeah, check that out at sltrib.com. I'll just mention here at the end, the governor's declaration will also trigger loans to farmers. I guess they're
Oh,
quite
yeah.
stressed.
Yeah, I think for sure farmers are going to be very stressed out. Like some of them may only get one cutting of hay this year, which is not enough. And even some communities that are dependent on groundwater. Not farming, but like some of our rural communities, they are not even going to be able to water their lawns this year. It is that bad in some parts of the state. There is just no water available, so it's scary. So they'll need some financial assistance too, in case they need to drill their wells deeper or something to keep providing for their communities. So it's going to be a stressful year for a lot of people, I think.
We've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune, the water and land use reporter Leah Larson. Leah, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Have a good weekend.
You too. And following a break on Behind the Headlines, we'll be talking with reporter Tony Semerad. He's been talking to ranchers in the Box Elder County area, seeing what they think about this new massive data center coming in. There's mixed opinions. We'll hear about that following a break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Here's the headline we'll be talking about in this segment. Not all Box Elder County ranchers agree with the Utah House Speaker on data center project plans. We bring in Salt Lake Tribune reporter Tony Semerad. Tony, thanks.
Hey, you bet, Tom. Thank you.
So you've been talking to ranchers, ag operators up there in Box Elder County in that Hansel Valley area. I guess, first of all, that reference to Speaker Schultz, he has land, I guess, up near there. Remind us what he said.
Well, yeah. So in an event towards the end of last week, House Speaker Mike Schultz, I guess, sort of sought to distance himself from this Box Elder County a data center, just noting that he did own ranching property in the general vicinity, but it wasn't sort of proximal to this 40,000 acre sort of footprint that Maida has carved out for this thing. And in the process of sort of expressing concerns about the environmental impact out there, he kind of basically said that like all ranchers out there, I don't love it. Sort of expressing some reservations about it. And since word of this project first emerged, as part of the Tribune's coverage, I had analyzed a number of parcels, land parcels that both are included in this big footprint in the Hansel Valley, and then properties that kind of surround those that abut them but aren't included. And a very interesting sort of cultural picture, if you will, it emerged. There remain these very large dryland ranches up in that area. Most of the land that is being contributed to this those 40,000 acres are owned by a large largely family-held ranching companies, a number of family trusts. And it turns out the picture that emerges is a lot of these are multi-generational are ranches that have operated there in some cases going back almost to the post-Civil War era and when that area was first kind of being settled. And yes, indeed, they really fall. The ones that I've interviewed and whose testimony I've listened to, they really do fall kind of on a spectrum with regard to this data center. There are large ranchers up in that area who are contributing substantial amounts of property to make it happen. And one in particular, the Munns family up there. A couple of members of that family have characterized their participation as sort of a move to help preserve ranching up there. They're surrendering a small part of the land that they actually own, and they hope to sort of keep going and pass this ranching way of life on to subsequent generations. And those generations are actually working on the ranches. And are eager to take over. So, there are also people that are kind of ambivalent, ranchers that are ambivalent. Anybody that has driven cattle or sheep across those sort of salty desert ecosystems in that area knows that water is of an intense premium, and so you do have concerns among ranchers who want to preserve their way of life up there that aren't participating, but whose land may kind of abut the Stratos project, that are very worried about the effects on local aquifers and air quality is another factor. Interestingly, a lot of the locals up there are concerned about traffic on these sort of small remote rural roads. The Salt Wells Road came up a number of times in some of the testimony. These are, basically just rural, very, very small roads with a lot of, blind spots and that sort of thing. So if you're a local up there, one of the worries about the prospect of having 2,000 new jobs fed by this data center is additional traffic on some of those roads up there. You have adjacent property owners that are kind of neutral, if you will. They don't feel they have interests on both sides. They could see benefits, they could see drawbacks, but they're really sort of situating this more in terms of like, okay, how is this going to help me kind of continue to do what I've done. This has obviously been a kind of a marginal lifestyle for many, many generations, and One of the ranchers raised concerns that if property values were to increase dramatically due to this, would that eventually force other future generations, unable to afford, say property taxes or to keep marginal agricultural land going when it's could be sold at a premium, that could also affect the ranching way of life. But the bottom line is you have a number of people whose families have lived on the land for all of these years, almost like sort of a frontier way of life that persists in this rural area. But now it's kind of juxtaposed with, this very sort of powerful symbol of a technological future. And, those two factors up in that area are coming right up against each other. One footnote, a lot of the ranchers that are supportive of this are buying into or supporting, I should say, the kind of U.S. military aspect of this. This has been portrayed by Kevin O'Leary and some of the investors as a move to kind of keep the U.S. Ahead in the artificial intelligence and technology realm, and sort of out of a patriotic spirit, there are some of the ranchers up there that, they feel like they're contributing to that side of the mission as well. So yeah, a really interesting and wide spectrum of opinions up there, but also a very interesting glimpse of a kind of a remnant of frontier life that goes on in that sort of western and central area of Box Elder County.
Yeah, it's interesting. Following up on that, the Munns said that they'll sell a small portion of their land. That'll help them to continue the next generation to ranch up there. Luann Adams, you quote her family operated a historic ranch. She said kind of the opposite. They were offered money for their land, but that couldn't buy replacement range. So they've declined because they want to continue the next generations.
Yeah, and I think you can, sort of reading between the lines, you can sense the ways in which they cherish this kind of persisting ranching life. There are details to both the Munns and the Adams and to other well-established families out there that really show the way in which they kind of love this heritage and they want to keep it going.
You quote, at the end of your story, I thought this is a good way to end it. Jay Stocking owns land up there. He says, maybe it'll bring better roads. Either way, we'll keep running our cows.
Yeah, there are people that they just want to keep on going up there.
Yeah. Let's change to some breaking news. The ongoing story of the sexual misconduct allegations against former, now Salt Lake City Council member, Eva Lopez Chavez. So I guess tell us, first of all, what she's been booted off the council, I guess.
Yeah, so there have been some very fast-moving kind of news associated with former council member Eva Lopez Chavez and the council's kind of the broader council in the kind of late April window. As you mentioned, these allegations of sexual misconduct emerged, of course, they involve one of the four people that had come forward accusing Lopez Chavez of allegedly restraining them during what they considered to be unwanted sexual advances. One of these accusers is, of course, another member of the council, Victoria Petro. So it's been a very kind of sensitive situation with regard to the dynamic on the council. But in a somewhat sort of unrelated move in all of this, a constituent in District 4, the district that Lopez Chavez formally represented, filed a complaint alleging that she hadn't met the residency requirements in the district. She'd purchased a home in another district at one point and was sort of living among several locations, and after looking into this, the city recorder concluded that indeed she had failed to maintain this sort of residency standard. And under state law and city rules, that vacated her seat. That meant essentially she was disqualified from holding that seat and has since been removed, if you will. So kind of superimposed over that fast-moving timeline, the council had set a course where it had created a working group among three of its members, members Chris Wharton, Dan Dugan, and Erica Carlson, were going to sort of head up a working group that would hire an independent investigator and delve into these sexual misconduct allegations, kind of in connection with a look and a potential revision to the council's own kind of code of conduct, you know, in terms of how should the council handle these kinds of situations in future. They pretty much around the same time that the city recorder concluded that she had failed to maintain residency, the council set this kind of investigative course. Now with her off the council, less than a week later or a week later, they voted to change course and not embark on that kind of investigation, to focus on their own kind of code of conduct. And so there was kind of an about face, if you will, in the light of Lopez Chavez stepping down from her District 4 seat in terms of how this working group was going to proceed. The council has sort of unanimously decided that kind of an investigation would not be appropriate at this time, just given that the council's resources are devoted to some pretty hefty matters at this time, particularly the latest budget that the mayor has proposed has a sizable tax increase involved and a number of utility rate increases involved. This has engrossed the council's attention on the budget. They don't really feel like they have the resources to expend on this kind of an investigation. And it's in some follow-up conversations with Council Chairman Alejandro Puy, he's also noted that, you know, the council wouldn't necessarily have jurisdiction to investigate someone that's now sort of a private citizen, and what role would the council play in investigating these allegations and kind of what the context would be. Shortly after the council's vote this week to kind of change course and not investigate the allegations and focus on its code of conduct, Lopez Chavez issued a pretty much her first statement on this aspect of the situation so far, saying she really very much lamented the fact that the council would not be investigating. She wants an opportunity, according to her, to kind of clear her name, to have those allegations explored. She's, of course, denied any kind of wrongdoing with regard to what these four people from Utah political circles have, alleged. She's also vowing to fight the city recorder's decision to vacate her seat. She's said in this statement sent out yesterday, she said that she's going to explore all of her legal options with regard to contesting that decision as well. So, like I say, just a lot of interesting sort of news overlays in terms of all of this. But for now, the council is going to focus on business as usual, particularly the budget and continue its debate on the code of conduct, but will not be investigating. And Lopez Chavez is saying she's kind of disappointed about that and thinks that the perceived integrity of City Hall is at stake and is really, as I say, lamenting the fact that they're not going to explore these misconduct allegations.
Thanks for telling us about these three stories. So we've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Tony Semrad. Tony, thank you so much.
Hey, thank you, Tom.
And on Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Following a brief break, we'll be talking with State Watch reporter Emily Anderson Stern. Here's the headline. Utah's top lawmaker has received huge sums from companies and lobbyists with MIDA projects. We'll have more following this break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. We bring in State Watch reporter Emily Anderson Stern in this segment of the program. Emily, thank you so much.
Thanks, Tom.
Here's the headline we'll talk about. Utah's top lawmaker has received huge sums from companies and lobbyists with MIDA projects. We're talking about Senate President Stuart Adams. I guess, first of all, we've been hearing a lot about MIDA with the data center. That's the place to start. What is MIDA?
So MIDA is an entity that was created by the legislature, and that Stuart Adams has been involved with for nearly two decades. It essentially takes land that is owned by the U.S. military that it is, you know, selling off or looking to do something with, and will make it into some sort of economic development opportunity. So, for example, if you're driving by Hill Air Force Base in Davis and Weber counties, you will see that in recent years, you know, they've built a bunch of restaurants, fast food restaurants. There's a Starbucks. You will see business buildings that are right on the base where, you know, civilians work. And a lot of that came through MIDA. They have increased their projects in recent years. So, you know, Deer Valley expanded eastward. And that was through a MIDA project. They are doing things up at Sundance Ski Resorts, at Camp Williams, the Utah National Guard camp on the border of Salt Lake and Utah counties. And that is, you know, that one is a nuclear project. So it's the projects they work on are pretty wide ranging, but all of it ties back to the military and then private economic development.
So the heart of this story is entities, persons donating to Senator Adams' PAC. And these people have, I guess, what, business or interest before MIDA?
Yeah, and the majority of the ones who did, well, all of the ones who did essentially worked on that Deer Valley project I mentioned, or had a business with that Deer Valley project. And they've been giving to PACs that Stuart Adams controls for years, and to Senate Republicans, essentially, you know, entities that it helps Stuart Adams if they are politically successful. And, you know, Salt Lake Tribune has reported on this before, first reported on it in 2023, after noticing a pattern in donations of out-of-state donors that really, I was confused as to what interests they may have had in Utah. And so looked into them and noticed that they were developing the Grand Hyatt Hotel, some of the luxury developments at what was then called Mayflower, and eventually now is Deer Valley Ski Resort.
Now, potential concern would be with any of the donations like this, that are the donations influencing the politician to make decisions in their favor? What does Senator Adams say?
He said that these donations have not influenced the decisions of MIDA at all. And he's especially saying that there are no ties to the data center, which has drawn national attention and scrutiny. And, you know, he did, as I was looking through donations, there's nothing that is directly tied to the data center. But some of the lobbyists that have been hired by Kevin O'Leary, the Canadian investor who is working to get this data center built, the lobbyists that he hired, they have been, you know, lobbyists are often prolific donors to politicians here in Utah, but they have been donating to some of these PACs, and so there is some influence there as well.
What are some of the companies or people who've been donating to Senator Adams? I guess maybe first of all, have some of these people been donating to other politicians in Utah?
So there's one who has been donating to other politicians, but those are largely other Republican politicians who can support these projects or who work with Senate President Stuart Adams. And that would be Gary Burnett. He's a developer from New York City, develops a lot of luxury buildings there in New York City, luxury condominiums. And he is pr the most prolific donor of the group, and has been donating to causes and Republican causes here in Utah, essentially since he started having business here in Utah. What's interesting about him is that if you go back and look at his political donations before coming to Utah to work on this, if you look at Federal Election Commission filings, he donated to a lot of Democratic candidates across the country and was and donated Democratic causes. But then in Utah, as he started these projects where, our legislature is a Republican supermajority, then he all of his donations started being to Republicans. There are other companies, of course, that have business in front of Ida who gave recent large donations to Stuart Adams. And they have not given donations, at least of that size, in recent years that I could find as I come through the state's campaign finance database. And a lot of those donations came with interesting timing as Senate President Adams is facing a couple of primary challengers.
Yeah, tell me about that.
Yeah, so Senate President, he had a handful of people file to run against him in the Republican primary this year. One person actually qualified for the ballot by collecting signatures. So she did not qualify at the state convention with delegate support. That's Stephanie Hollist, and she used to be the attorney for Weber State University. And another challenger actually used to work with Adams. He was an attorney for the legislature. His name's Braden Hess, and he qualified at the state nominating convention late last month with getting delegate support. And so when primary ballots go out in June, folks will see a couple names next to President Adams. And it's a lot of these donations came within a week of that state nominating convention when it became clear that President Adams would face a couple of primary challengers and that there wasn't enough support even among delegates to reduce the amount of challengers he would see, right? Because Braden Hess got enough support at that nominating convention to make the ballot with Adams. And so a big chunk of those donations came on May 1st. The nominating convention was on April 25th. And there's nearly $140,000 that was put into the account of a political action committee that President Adams runs as a leadership committee, Adams Leadership PAC. And that came from construction companies, contractors who worked on buildings at the Deer Valley expansion.
So Gary Barnett or any of the other donors, have they made public statements about their donations?
Yeah, so I spoke to in 2023, I spoke to a spokesperson for Extel, the company that Gary Barnett owns, asking essentially why Gary Barnett has been donating to these causes. And she said, that she can't exactly like speak for Gary Barnett, but she did say, quote, "In the state of Utah, we can look around and there's a clear understanding of the importance of the Republican Party here, and particularly President Stuart Adams." And then she talked about how the Republican Party has done a good job of managing the economy here. But effectively, it was a nod to that's who's in power in Utah and who are the decision makers.
You have a sub headline here. Did money influence the data center decision? So moving to the data center, do we have any information at all on that?
Well, what we have seen is the lobbyists who the companies largely pushing for the data center have hired. And MITA has its own lobbyists too. And the key lobbyists for MITA are also the lobbyists for O'Leary's venture capital company. And so they're working on that. The lobbyists are pushing for like the data center, both on behalf of MITA and O'Leary. The firm they hired is actually one of the biggest lobbyist firms in the state, Lincoln Hill Partners. Utah Attorney General Derrick Brown was a partner at Lincoln Hill Partners when he was ran for attorney general. So that gives you kind of a taste of how large and influential this firm is. But as they've had news conferences on the data center, you'll see there was Casey Hill of Lincoln Hill Partners representing O'Leary. And Lincoln Hill, as it's one of the largest lobbying firms in the state, has been a longtime donor to a lot of state lawmakers. But Casey Hill specifically, his company, he has his own company of that has done lobbying work. Both tied to Lincoln Hill and not tied to Lincoln Hill, called Red Hill Strategies. And it gave $5,000 to Senate President Stuart Adams on April 27th, just the day before O'Leary had hired his partner, Lincoln Schertz. And then a few days later, according to state lobbying filings, they hired Casey Hill. And so I reached out to Casey Hill to ask about that donation, whether it was tied to the data center and his work for Kevin O'Leary, and he didn't respond to me. But these donations do raise questions about what influence money coming from lobbyists has had on the data center. We haven't seen any of the donations to the Box Elder County Commissioners who approved the data center. They do not have to disclose any of their campaign finance contributions until 1 week before the June primary. And two of those three commissioners are up for re-election. And so it'll be interesting to see whether stakeholders in this project gave money there too.
Just one final thing you note in your story, I believe Utah has, on the spectrum of restrictive versus non-restrictive, kind of on the non-restrictive end in terms of disclosure requirements, right, and donation limits.
Yeah, Utah has some of the loosest campaign finance laws in the country. It has zero limits for either individuals or for contributions. So contributions can essentially give unlimited amounts of money to politicians who are making decisions on the projects that they're working on. And so you'll see massive sums, massive donations here in Utah all the time, $50,000 donations, things like that, that just would not be possible in, say, federal elections or in a lot of other states across the country. According to the National Conference of State Legislatures, Utah's one of only five states that doesn't have political contribution limits for corporations. And it makes going through campaign finance donations quite interesting.
Well, we've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune State Watch reporter Emily Anderson Stern, telling us about this. Emily, thank you so much.
Thanks, Tom.
And you are listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Our thanks to everyone who participated today. And I'm Tom Williams. Hope you'll be with me again for the program next week.